Graphic Audio, a movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's Smoke Jensen, The Mountain Man, 16. Spirit of the Mountain Man. Narrated by Mort Shelby. With performances by James Lewis, Tim Carlin, Elizabeth Jernigan, Tim Getman, David Coyne, Ren Casey, Jeff Baker, Joe Brack, Terrence Aselford, Dylan Lynch, Michael Glenn, Thomas Penny, Stephen Carpenter, Christopher Graybill, Tony Knob, Christopher Shearer, James Konachek, Richard Rowan, Michael John Casey, Ken Jackson, Eric Messner, Peter Stray, Johann Detweiler, Chris Rowan, Colleen Delaney, Nathaniel Perry, Greg Reinhold, and Nanette Savard. Sliding languidly in big oily swirls over a few submerged sandbars, the red-brown surface of the Colorado River glided past the low native stone buildings on the isolated knoll. The complex rested well above the sandy ochre floodplain, beyond the maximum high water mark. According to the Army engineers who designed the structure, it made the ideal location for a prison. For that was the purpose of this high-walled, forbidden construction. Yuma Territorial Prison. It housed the hardest of hard cases, the most unrepentant road agents, bank robbers, and highwaymen, the wife and baby killers who had escaped from other institutions to kill again and never show a flicker of remorse. At the quarry, guards' whistles announced the noon hour, and men working on the rock pile lowered their hammers. They shambled wearily through the shimmering midday desert heat to find what solace they could in the shadows of an overhanging wall of the strip quarry. Among them, three men stood out from the rest. Victor Spector would never be mistaken for a drifter or a highwayman. A graduate of Yale, he had the look about him of a businessman, albeit one who kept himself in excellent condition. Trim, with hard muscles in his mid-40s, he had only the beginnings of a pot belly. The latter had developed quite a lot during his 7 years in various prisons. He used to be the brains behind and leader of a large outlaw gang that operated in Missouri, Kansas, and Colorado. He had lived the good life in luxurious splendor in a fancy St. Louis hotel and directed the actions of his vast gang from there. That is, until his greed and the viciousness of his underlings attracted the wrong sort of attention. That's when he met up with trouble. And it was spelled Smoke Jensen. They had a series of violent encounters. Since that time, Spectre's thick shock of black hair had a white streak to the left of his part, caused by a bullet fired by Smoke Jensen. The slug had knocked him unconscious and saved his life. His 18-year-old son, Trenton, hadn't fared so well. Originally sentenced to hang, Victor Spector's money and influence got his death warrant commuted to life in prison. With icy green eyes and thick, bristly brows which met in the middle of his forehead when angered, he quickly became the head cock on the yard at any institution in which he had been incarcerated. It also earned him frequent transfers when enemies and rivals among the prison population turned up mysteriously dead. No different from previous occasions, Victor Spector had assumed leadership over his two present companions. Ralph Tinsdale was a contemporary of Victor Spector. He had a thick build, going somewhat to pot with advancing years and a starchy prison diet. He used to be a big land speculator who obtained prime ranches and city properties by the simple expedient of having the owners killed and dealing with the widows. He had been in the process of acquiring from a silver-haired dowager a choice square block in the heart of the business district of Denver when he discovered that the late Harrison Tate had been a close personal friend of one Smoke Jensen. Quite quickly, Smoke Jensen wrote finis to the evil machinations of Ralph Tinsdale. In their final confrontation, Smoke had left Tinsdale for dead at the bottom of a deep ravine with two bullet holes in the belly. Tinsdale had survived with large scars and a permanent limp. Smoke found that out when he was called to testify at the trial. When the guilty verdict came in and the judge sentenced him to life in prison, Tinsdale cursed Smoke hotly in language unbecoming the stylish clothing the swindler wore. His time in prison had failed to mellow him any. Tinsdale had grown slack behind bars so that his once lustrous hair had turned a mousy brown, poorly cared for, and his once natty pencil-lined mustache had been replaced by a scraggly wisp of its former self. Only his hatred of Smoke Jensen gave him a semblance of youthful vigor. Enough, though, that he was accepted as second-in-command of the unholy trio. Olin Buckner had nearly 10 years on his associates. His auburn hair, which had faded to mostly gray, was worn slicked back tightly on a long skull. He had a porcine appearance, enhanced by a jowly face with a pug nose and small, deep-set black eyes. An over-large mouth and big ears added to the illusion. He had already developed a middle-aged spread. Once, though, he had been trim and almost compulsively active. He had owned an entire town in south-central Montana. Most of it he had acquired by unlawful means, and he ruled with an iron fist until he tried to drive out the daughter of a mysteriously and recently deceased friend of Smoke Jensen. Smoke went after Buckner with a particular vengeance. Olin Buckner replied by hiring an army of gunfighters, putting a bounty on the head of Smoke Jensen, and sitting back to enjoy the results. Buckner might have been a fine, skillful fisherman, but he had never hooked a shark before. When Smoke Jensen got through with him, he had lain in a hospital bed for 5 months before he could stand upright, and another 3 before he could be brought to trial. Like the others, his residual wealth and influence bought him a commutation of sentence. The hangman was cheated, and Buckner went to the worst prisons in the West. He ended up in Yuma and soon found a common bond between himself and the other two. Now, this trio of the lowest form of human debris stood quietly in line to take a bowl and a tin cup in turn and shuffle past the trustees who dispensed the midday meal. Each inmate received a large dipper of a thin soup purported to be chicken, but lacking even the sight of a speck of meat. They also got a half a round loaf of sourdough bread. Then, they retreated to the blessing of shade. As always, the topic of conversation among Spector, Tinsdale, and Buckner centered on Smoke Jensen.
I hate that bastard. I've not been able to enjoy a day or night without pain since Jensen shot me. I want him dead. No. Crippled and suffering would be better.
Well, Olin, you know I have ample cause to despise Smoke Jensen. I was a man of consequence and ample means before Jensen thrust himself into my affairs, and life among prisoners and guards has further destroyed me.
And you have destroyed a few of them, Ralph.
I was not afforded the respect I deserved, Victor.
I have no reason to love Smoke Jensen, as you well know. He maimed me and murdered my son, took everything from me, and it galls my ass.
Quiet down over there! No talking among the prisoners! You 3 know the rules!
The guard eventually turned away.
and it galls my ass that there is not a thing we can do about it from inside here. Smoke Jensen is free as a bird to go and do anything he wants with no harm to him.
I'd give a hell of a lot to see it otherwise.
Ralph Tinsdale studied Victor Spector.
Are you proposing we find a way to get out of here?
I think that would go a long way toward accomplishing our mutual goal, to bring an end to the career and life of Smoke Jensen.
It won't be easy.
No, and as I said, we can't do it from here. We will have to find a way to escape.
No talking among prisoners.
The guard's Winchester was no longer on his shoulder, but held competently at Highport in a menacing manner.
I warned you three jailhouse lawyers once. This is the second time. There won't be a third. You'll be taken direct to the Sunbox.
The three master criminals froze in silence. They knew all too much about the ingenious variation on solitary confinement employed at Yuma Territorial Prison. Four coffin-like boxes of sheet iron and rock had been constructed in the center of the yard. They were so small a man could not lie down, could not even sit properly with the door closed and locked. The only openings were tiny barred holes in the upper part of each door. Each of the recent arrivals at the institution had heard the screams, wails, and blubberings of men driven mad in the heat of a sunbox. Finally, the guard turned away again. Buckner leaned forward.
Find some way this afternoon to be sent to the infirmary. We can talk freely there.
Spring had awakened new buds on the aspen trees of the High Lonesome, which had unfolded into tender, pale green leaves. The meadows and pastures of the Sugarloaf had turned emerald. Warm, soft breezes called longingly to those with sufficiently sensitive natures. One of those was a tall, broad-shouldered man with faint streaks of gray in his hair. He set his coffee cup on the plank flooring of the porch and came to his feet, then turned to the lovely woman beside him.
I think it's time to go fishing. I'll take Bobby along and get in 3 or 4 days on Silver Creek and over Honey Spring Way.
That boy has yet to finish his study, Smoke.
Sally, there's a universe of learning out there in this country. He can learn biology, botany, even weather studies.
I see. Also a lot about rainbow and brown trout, I'll wager.
Smoke took her outstretched hands and raised her from the wooden rocking chair. He remained amazed that she had never lost her youthful figure. The years and 5 children should have done some damage, yet he could detect none at all.
You'll win the bet. The last day we'll catch a mess and bring them home to you. Have some fresh biscuits waiting. And a pie. We have to have a nice pie.
Do we? Cherry or blackberry?
Whatever you pick will be all right with me. I'll go get Bobby and we'll round up our gear.
Bobby Harris had been living with the Jensens since he became an orphan at the age of 10. He was bright and energetic, although at times a bit forgetful of the limitations of a small boy. Right now, he was risking any future progeny on the saddle of an unbroken Mustang. Smoke rode in close and held his peace, gloved hands folded on the saddle horn of his big Palouse stallion Thunder. The spunky lad came to his boots and dusted off his jeans and chaps.
Damn, Nathan!
Bobby saw Smoke Jensen.
Sorry, Smoke. I didn't see you. Well, heck, what's a damn or two between two friendly men?
I thought you might be in a mood for something a little less strenuous than breaking Mustangs.
Bobby limped to the fence and squirmed through the 2 lower poles.
Like what?
Seems to me it's time to go hog out a few rainbows. Think you'd like that?
Oh, you bet I would. Where'd we go? How long?
I thought we'd angle up Silver Spring ways, then head over toward Honey Spring. Be gone, 3 or 4 days.
Oh, hot damn!
Bobby.
Yes, sir?
You just reached your damn limit.
Yes, sir. I'll go get ready. Oh, this is great, Smoke. It smells so good up here. Pine and blue spruce and grass growing like crazy. There's water up ahead. I can smell that too.
Smoke grinned. In a week, two at most, Bobby would be headed for Big Rock in the little red schoolhouse at the end of Main Street. It had been arranged for him to live there while being schooled with his best friend, Sammy. Smoke was glad to have this time with the boy.
We gonna build a lean-to or sleep out under the stars?
We can do whatever you want.
Then can you tell me some stories about you and Preacher? About back when you were my age?
I didn't know Preacher when I was your age. I was 14, I think, when I wound up lost out here and on my own.
So? Oh, go on.
Tonight, over fish and biscuits.
Promise?
Promise.
Toward mid-afternoon, Smoke Jensen called a halt to their journey. He used a short-handled axe to cut down a dozen forearm-thick saplings, bundled them, and tied them off behind the pack horse. They traveled on to a moderate clearing with plenty of grass for the horses and shaded by big old blue spruce. It towered a good 60 feet into the air and had for at least 250 years miraculously escaped the attention of the fierce lightning that crashed through these mountains and valleys each summer. With Bobby's help, Smoke quickly constructed a roomy lean-to and covered the long slant back and square sides with overlapping layers of pine bough. Then Bobby gathered firewood while Smoke made a fire ring from rocks gathered from the creek located a short distance from the camp. An hour before sundown, everything had been laid out in readiness. Outfitted with a mason jar of live dragonflies and some of the newfangled artificial dry flies hooked into their shirt collars, man and boy set off to the east bank of Silver Creek.
Holy cow! Look at them all!
The water swarmed with mossy greenbacks. Hundreds of finny creatures filled the stream. Their deep color faded along their sides to the dividing line of rainbow colors. Beyond that, their white speckled bellies flashed brightly when one or another would roll gracefully after surfacing to snap up a winged insect.
Let's get to work.
Within half an hour, they had a dozen pan-sized trout. The larger ones they had unhooked and thrown back. Those they caught tomorrow would be filleted and smoked. Smoke got the fire going while Bobby cleaned the fish. The mountain man made biscuits and placed the pot of beans he had put to soaking over the fire on a trestle arm. Bobby washed and sliced onions and potatoes and put a large skillet of them on to fry. Smoke fried the fish. They ate it all and wiped their skillets with biscuit halves. Smoke leaned back and lighted a thin, hard, dry cigar.
Tell me about you and Preacher.
Well, where to begin? Had to be about 14 when Preacher hooked up with me in Pond, Kansas. Now, mind you, we didn't hit it off at first. Preacher was old, nearly as old as God the way I saw it. He was crotchety, set in his ways, and about as foul-mouthed as any 10 men could get. He could fill the air with blue smoke when he took to cussing. He was the best friend anyone could have, man or boy. He was kind, loyal, intelligent, and absolutely convinced that life as he lived it in the High Lonesome was the best sort of life anyone could ever have. He took me in after Pa died.
Tell me about one of you and Preacher's famous gunfight, Smoke.
Well, now, I recall the time when Preacher and I had to fight off 11 tough outlaws. The last of a gang that had been preying on immigrant trains along the North Platte. It was in the 60s then, and the army had mostly gone back east to fight for the Union, so the border riffraff grew bolder and bolder. This particular bunch had holed up in one of the trading posts they had robbed. Preacher and me had to go in after them.
Preacher eased his head up over the fallen log and peered closely at the tumble-down shack that housed the 11 vicious highwaymen. This was not any dance for a 17-year-old tadpole to join into, he figured. But Smoke was here and raring for a fight, so what could he do? He cut his eyes to where Smoke Jensen crouched between fat granite boulders some 20 yards away.
Good boy.
Preacher had taught the lad about not bunching up early in their time together. The main idea was to give whoever was shooting at you more air than meat for targets. That had been nearly 4 years ago. Now all the lessons on surviving in the big empty were about to be put to the test. Preacher slid the barrel of his .56 Hawken over the fallen tree and took aim on a windowpane. Behind it, he saw the head and shoulders of a human figure. Preacher eared back the hammer of the Hawken. From his vantage point, Smoke Jensen saw the human figure pop out of sight as though pulled by a rope. The flimsy pine board panel flew open. As instructed, Smoke fired at the doorway.
That's two down! You men in there best come out and surrender! We got you surrounded!
On two sides, anyway.
Like hell we will! We've been watching! There's more of us than you!
Not for long!
Preacher again took aim on the window.
Three down!
Smoke put a round through the open doorway. A body hit the floor just inside the open door.
God damn it, drag Rafe back out of there. We gotta close that door.
You drag his ass away from there.
I'm gut shot, Weasel. I ain't gonna make it.
Then crawl out of the damn door so we can close it.
I can't, Weasel. I hurt too much.
Ah, for Christ's sake.
Damn, Weasel, you killed Rafe.
That's right. Now drag the body out of the damn way and let's get down to business.
Preacher had trained to Smoke well. When the man inside bent over the dead Rafe...
He got me in the cheek, Weasel!
How the hell are you talking then?
Not that cheek!
Stop your caterwauling! We gotta get him! By my count, there's only two. I say we rush him!
Weasel and his henchmen didn't even get the chance. Preacher's next blind shot through the opaque window shattered a kerosene lamp, and the whole shelter went up in flames. Close of fire, three men ran from the doorway, their weapons forgotten. Preacher dropped first one, and then another with a pistol ball from his Model 60 Colt. Smoke fired at a third who went to one knee, shot through the side. Weasel and a couple more stubbornly insisted on fighting it out from inside.
Well, when it was over, that shack had burned to the ground, with Weasel and everyone else still in it. And that's how Preacher handled that.
Smoke Jensen looked down at Bobby Harris to find the boy with his head on one crooked arm, his eyes closed in a sound sleep.
Was I that boring?
Smoke settled in at Sugan's and closed his eyes under the starry sky. Outside, darkness lay in a heavy blanket over the Yuma Territorial Prison compound. Droopy-eyed guards stood watch in the eight turret-like towers atop the walls at each corner and in the middle of each span. Inside, in his cell, Victor Spector set his plan into operation with a prearranged signal. It was simplicity in its most distilled form. They would incapacitate the turnkey, get out of the cell block, knock out the guards and pitch them over the side, then follow them on ropes made of torn blankets. Buckner began to bang the bars of the cell he shared with Tinsdale with a tin cup.
Hey! Hey, turnkey! There's a sick man in here!
No answer. Not even a light at the end of the corridor outside the open-fronted cells.
Damn it! I mean it! He's powerful sick!
At last, a light did come, weakly, from a hooded kerosene lantern.
Do that racket!
My cellmate is powerful sick! It's that rotten pork we had at supper! He's about to die on me!
Have him report to the infirmary in the morning!
He's not gonna last until morning, boss! Come take a look for yourself. He's all gray and green and his eyes are rolled up. Hurry!
Son of a bitch. All right, hold your horses.
Good God, you weren't kidding. He looks like he's already dead.
See? I told you.
To his credit, the guard locked the cell door behind him before he crossed to the bunk.
Oh, shit, look at him!
That guard had no way of knowing that the pale gray-green phase had been achieved by mixing whitewash powder with scrapings from an ancient copper deposit in the quarry. He bent to get a closer look. Olin Buckner snaked an arm around his neck and began to squeeze.
He's dead. Get the keys, Ralph. Help me put him in the bunk where you were.
Buckner and Tinsdale gathered their makeshift ropes and slung the coils over both shoulders. Then Tinsdale unlocked the door and stepped out under the overhang of the second-tier catwalk. Buckner followed. They went directly to the cell that held Victor Spector and his cellmate. Spector waited for him at the bars. Spector's cellmate awakened as the bar door swung open. It only took him a few seconds to realize what was at hand.
Hey, take me along. Hell, man, I'm doing life like the rest of you. You gotta take me.
We do not have to take you anywhere, Cheney.
Yeah? Listen, Spector, you don't take me, I'll make a fuss, get you caught. It'll be a flogging and another 5 years for attempted escape. You best be taking me.
Resignation shadowed the face of Victor Spector. He nodded curtly and gestured toward the cell door.
Fine, fine, you win. Just get moving.
That's mighty white of you.
When Cheney stepped forward to exit the cell, Victor Spector slid a hand-fashioned stone shank out of the sleeve of his shirt, gripped the cloth-wrapped hilt, and drove the needle point deep into the right kidney of the other prisoner. Swiftly, he slashed from side to side, withdrew it, and then destroyed the second vital organ. He eased the wounded man onto a bunk.
He'll bleed to death internally in less than 4 minutes. Let's get going, shall we?
The trio headed for the barred stairway at the opposite end of the corridor from where the turnkey had appeared. The key turned, and the bolt slid back. Stealthily, the three escapees traversed the stairs. At the top, they found the first guard in his corner tower. His chin rested on his chest. Buckner bashed him in the side of the head to ensure he would not awaken for a while, then hoisted the slumped body and dumped him over the side. The other pair crawled along the parapet to the middle watch post. They found this guard staring out toward the river, contrary to his standing orders to look inward at the prison. On a signal from Specter, they swarmed over him. In a second, he joined his fellow guard. Spectre motioned Buckner forward and began to fasten one end of his rope to a roof support of the mid-wall tower. Tinsdale did the same, as did Buckner when he reached him. They slid down the rampart with surprise and ease, only to find their rope some 15 feet short. The barrier had been footed in bedrock, and the yard was that much higher than the ground outside. Not liking it, though liking the alternatives even less, Victor Spector let go and dropped to the rocky ground below. Good fortune went with him. He didn't twist an ankle on any loose stones. Tinsdale came next and hit on his rump. Lastly, Buckner let go. A sharp pain shot through his left ankle. He had severely sprained it.
What do we do now?
Go on this plan. Ralph and I will find a boat, bring it here and pick you up. Make your way down to the river.
20 minutes later, the blunt prow of a river punt came into view through the limited starlight. Biting back shafts of pain, Buckner hobbled to the gunwale and his companions hauled him aboard. They pushed out into the stream, leaving the guards behind, one with a broken neck. They headed northeastward, although Mexico lay a scant few miles the other direction. It had been Tinsdale's contribution that they would stand a better chance by going the long way, which would be least expected, rather than south into sure capture by the rurales in Mexico. All in all, it proved a clever twist in their plan. On the third day of their fishing trip, Smoke Jensen sat on a large, water-smoothed flat rock and watched Bobby cast his line and lazy serpentines across the surface of Honey Spring. Smoke leaned on one elbow, took a puff on a cigar, and reflected on their time alone together as the gray-white streamers drifted upward from his mouth. He felt he had made some progress with the boy. Bobby had opened up to him, more so than at any time in the past. A sudden movement on the water brought Smoke abruptly upright. A big old brown broke the surface and went for the man-made dry fly at the end of Bobby's line.
Oh, got him!
The boy was a natural fisherman, more so than Smoke. He knew instinctively just when to set the hook, how hard to yank, and how long to play the catch before landing it. Suddenly, his bare foot slipped on a mossy rock.
Whoa!
Bobby fell into the water.
Oh! Ouch, my ankle! Oh, shoot! Get him, Smoke! Hurry, or we'll get away!
Trout, line, and pole had started away from the shore of the pond. Smoke bounded into the water and snagged the cane rod by the butt, yanked and retrieved enough to fight the fish.
I got it. Now, get out of the water. You'll catch your death.
Hey, Smoke. Ow! Ouch! Oh, that really hurts.
Dripping, Bobby climbed from Honey Spring Pond and stood on shore.
Get out of those clothes. Wrap up in a blanket. I'll build a fire after I catch your fish.
20 minutes later, found him drying off beside a hat-sized fire. Bobby's teeth still chattered, and he had a blue ring around his lips. Water dripped from his longish blonde hair, and the sharp points of his shoulder blades could be seen through the blanket that covered him.
It's sure too bad that these mountain waters aren't like those around Model and Tempest. I sure would like to go for a swim.
Well, something you'll have to live without in this part of Colorado.
Oh, damn.
Smoke's head turned sharply towards Bobby.
Darn, I meant darn, darn. Don't you think maybe by July the water will be warm enough? It is in Big Rock.
It might be for you, but to me it's too cold. Now, get to work at warming up.
When the shivers had ceased, Smoke examined Bobby's ankle. What he saw troubled him.
I don't think it's broken, but that ankle is swollen too much to get back in your boot. Get dressed while I think of what to do next.
Yes, sir.
When Bobby had restored himself in his clothing, he turned an anxious face to Smoke. Smoke Jensen rubbed his jaw with long, thick fingers.
You're not going to be able to keep on out here. Thing to do is turn back for the Sugarloaf.
Well, what about the fish you were going to smoke?
I figure they'll get smoked like we intended.
How?
Since you know where the house is from here, and you're big enough anyway, you can ride on in by yourself.
Really? You mean it?
Yep. I'll help you load up and see you on your way. Then come back and pull out a nice mess. Tell Sally I'll ride in late the day after tomorrow, right before supper.
15 minutes later, saw the injured boy on his way. Bobby had a .38 Colt Lightning tucked in his waistband, and his Stetson sat at a jaunty angle on his straw-colored hair. He waved confidently to Smoke, who waggled his hat in the air. Smoke wanted very much to give the lad confidence in his ability to care for himself. After all, he was 13 now.
You'll do fine. Just fine.
Alone now, and content with it, Smoke continued to fish into mid-morning. When he made a dozen casts and failed to get a single rise, let alone a strike, he decided to quit until evening feeding time. He had already smoked 2 dozen and would set his morning's catch to a smudgy aspen and hickory fire right after his noon meal. With what he could catch this afternoon, he would have a fair supply to take home the next day. With his mind made up, he began to roll the line onto his pole. With his gear packed up, he turned to head for his camp.
Whoops.
Right then, a very hungry bear, fresh out of hibernation, ambled down to the water for something to eat. Its small, myopic eyes did not at first take in the figure of a lone human. Smoke was in a dilemma. The fishing pole was no defense whatever, and a handgun, even a hefty .45 Colt, would hardly be enough to take on a bear. A moment later, the Bruin discovered Smoke. In its ill-tempered mood, the grizzly saw the man as a threat to its territory. The animal charged. Set! Smoke took flight, his creel and pole left behind. It soon turned into a close race, with the speedy grizzly closing ground with each bound of its oddly articulated hind legs. Smoke won, though only by a hair. He scaled the first 12 feet of a slender pine. Once beyond the reach of the bear, he dug in his heels and shinned up 5 more feet, grabbed the lowest branch, and pulled himself even higher. With a powerful swing of his strong body, Smoke swung himself up to where he could straddle the branch. Now the sweat broke out. Below him, the grizzly assaulted the tree. It made a good 5 feet, but then slid back. Tossing his head, the bear began to circle the pine. After a third pass around the trunk, the Bruin followed his nose to the wicker creel of the trout and ripped it open. Voraciously, it consumed every one, then went to the shore of the pond and waded out a ways. Competently, its long, sharp claws began to flash under the surface and come back out with a fat trout that flew sparkling through the air to land on the grassy bank. A disgruntled Smoke Jensen sat where he was and watched the bear work for an hour.
God damn it. When you've had your fill, you'll go away. Then I can get down, get thunder, and get the hell out of here.
9:00 found the grizzly still there. He yawned and stomped the ground and made frequent trips from tree to pond and pond to tree. Smoke hung on and sweated. He removed his belt and fastened it around the trunk and retreaded the buckle.
At least I won't fall asleep and become Bruin breakfast.
A thin sliver of moon appeared to float majestically through the plethora of stars in an inky sky. Below, the bear fell asleep. And so did Smoke. A squat, bow-legged man with grizzled, thinning hair looked up from his kitchen table at the sound of the thump that came from the small dock he had constructed out into the Colorado River.
Oh, visitors. And wouldn't you know it, right at breakfast time.
Hiram Wells cut his eyes to the cloth-draped larder. He knew by heart what was within it. Plenty of slab bacon, only 2 eggs. Chickens had been acting offish lately. Flour for biscuits, cornmeal too.
It'll serve. I could come out of it with a few cents in hard money. That would come in handy.
Hiram pushed back his chair and came to his feet. He reached the door in time to count 3 men approaching at a stiff gait. One of them, he noted, limped.
Morning. We'd be happy to pay you if you could fix us something for breakfast.
Hiram pondered a moment. They stood and carried themselves like men of quality, businessmen or the like. Yet they wore the threadbare pullover shirts and butternut linsey woolsey trousers with the broad black stripes that marked them as escaped convicts from the prison downriver at Yuma. A sudden chill struck him. Had he let them get too close already? Hiram decided to hedge.
I'm a tad light on supplies, gentlemen.
Anything will do, we're rather hungry.
The man had a cultured way of speaking, Hiram noted. Maybe he was mistaken about the clothes. Maybe they might be some back easty fashionable hunting togs.
Well, I reckon I can whip up some bacon and some scrambled eggs, biscuits or cornbread, have some honey.
That would be fine, just fine.
Hiram went to the stove and turned his back to him. That way he failed to note the quick exchange between the trio. His cartridge belt and Model 60 Remington conversion revolver hung on a peg in the wall. Above it hung a shotgun and a use shiny Winchester. But Hiram heard the strident click of sear notches as a hammer ratcheted back. Will slammed sideways into the wall and fell dead to the floor. Quickly, Ralph Tinsdale undertook the duties of the cook. He provided a warm meal in minimal time. Meanwhile, Victor Spector cut Olin Buckner out of his boot. They all 3 sat down and consumed the food hurriedly. With their bellies full, they took the flour, cornmeal, sugar and salt, a nib of lard, and the remaining portion of the bacon slab. Done up in a flour sack, the provender accompanied them as they went to the small barn in search of horses. An hour after sinking their escape boat, Victor Spector and his partners rode off without a trace. Morning found Smoke Jensen still literally up a tree. He awakened to loud growling from the bear and from his stomach. He hadn't eaten since the previous noon. Smoke opened gummy eyes and rubbed them, then looked down to find the grizzly reared back on his haunches, staring up. He had a hungry expression. A night in a tree without even a blanket had induced a lot of stiffness in Smoke. He hoped that it would not make him a quick snack for the bear. Abruptly, the Bruin came to all fours and resumed his circular post around the pine tree. Smoke looked on and considered his chances of killing the creature was 6 loads. At least he might incapacitate the animal and not have to track it down later. He had just about resigned himself to having to shoot the creature when it stopped pacing abruptly and reared on its massive hind legs. Its small pig eyes stared myopically while it turned its head from side to side as it listened to slight sounds as yet unheard by Smoke. The bear's ears twitched, the black muzzle pointed in the direction of the sound. Dropping to all fours, the animal bolted for hiding in a lumbering gait as 2 riders cantered into view. Smoke recognized them and wished that it had been anyone else but these two. Monte Carson reined in under the tree. His face wreathed in mirth, Hank Evans sat beside him.
Well, well, look what we have here.
Mid-morning sunlight winked off Monty's sheriff's badge.
What do you suppose got him up there?
Couldn't be that bear, could it? That big old grizzly bear?
Wait. You mean that little bitty fur ball that got scared off by horses?
That's it. That's the one.
Do you think you two could stop cackling like a barnyard full of hens long enough to give me a hand getting down?
Hank snaked a rope up to Smoke, who draped it over the limb. Then the last mountain man released himself from his emergency sling, restrung his belt, and swung 1 leg over the branch. Balanced sideways, he inserted a boot toe in the loop of the lariat and turned around to hang from his hands.
Lower away.
Smoke returned to solid ground. His mood didn't improve in the least while Monte Carson and Hank Evans plied him with questions about how he had been caught off guard by the grizzly. Hank laid a fire and filled a coffee pot with fresh water. He set that to boil and broke out Smoke's skillet.
I bet you're hungry, right?
Don't even mention it.
Bacon's eggs and fried taters?
Pound of bacon, 12 eggs, and 2 pounds of potatoes with onions, if you please. And that's just for starters. I may tell you a little about what happened after the first cup of coffee.
Monty stepped forward, extending a silver flask in 1 hand.
Got a little rye to spike it with.
Good. Damn good. Then you'll hear it all.
After Smoke had recounted his incident with the bear, with frequent interruptions of sniggers and out-and-out hee-haw braying laughter, he got around to asking Monty what had brought the lawman out from Big Rock.
Well, it might not mean anything at all. It's something I picked up from the telegraph. Only the names were familiar, and I did want an excuse to sample some of Sally's great pie, so I rode out to tell you about it.
And stop chasing around Murphy's barn and do it.
Monty told Smoke about the prison break. Smoke listened and shook his head.
I remember those 3 right well. I had no idea they had gotten together in prison. How'd a thing like that happen?
Considering the territorial prison at Yuma is the hellhole of the entire system, no doubt the worst all wind up there eventually. And there's more to the story. They badly injured 1 guard, killed another, and a turnkey on the way out.
And anyone else who gets in their way is going to be in danger, too.
After the noon hour, business had slackened off at the Grand Canyon Saloon in the Arizona town of the same name. At a table sequestered in a shadow-darkened corner, Spectre, Tinsdale, and Buckner sat conducting business. They had been in the settlement on the rim of the Grand Canyon for less than a day. A tall, lean, hard-looking man entered the saloon and approached their table. The stranger appeared to be in his mid-20s, and he didn't remove his hat or act in the least servile. At a distance of 3 feet, the man stopped.
I hear you're looking to hire some men.
We are. Are you by chance interested?
A fleeting, icy smile spread full lips.
Not by chance, but by lack of other employment. What is it you're hiring for?
We need men good with their guns, and I'd like to know the name of any man I'm talking business with.
My name's Jaeger. Gus Jaeger. My given name is Augustus, but it's a lot of work to get your tongue around, so I shortened it. Who might you be?
I am Victor Spector. These gentlemen are my partners in this little endeavor, Ralph Tinsdale and Olin Buckner. Now, Mr. Jaeger, take a seat and we can discuss this a little further.
Jaeger took one of the straight-back chairs, reversed it, and seated himself, while Spector signaled for the bartender for a round. When that had been duly delivered and the bartender absented himself, Spector steepled his fingers on the green table.
Now, would I be correct in the supposition that your current unemployment has something to do with the 3 years you spent in prison for stagecoach robbery, Mr. Jaeger?
Gus Jaeger went white from anger, and he clenched a fist.
The others in the gang got considerably more time for the same job, am I correct?
Jaeger's cold hazel eyes burned under black brows.
I hadn't pulled as many jobs as the others. What business is it of yours?
Oh, well, you see, we went through some of the sheriff's old wanted posters and reviewed past issues of the newspapers. Your name came up along with some others. We left invitations in their postal boxes, like the one you received. So far, you are the first to respond.
Jaeger's full, fleshy lips pulled wide in a rueful grin. He removed his Montana Peak Stetson, revealing thick black hair, and sailed it toward a row of hooks on a near wall. It caught and held. By then, he had recovered himself.
What exactly do you have in mind?
There is this man he needs doing away with.
There's three of you. Why don't you find them and do it yourselves?
It's not quite that easy.
He's a gunfighter.
Yes, Mr. Jaeger, he is.
Smiling, Jaeger knocked back his whiskey and tilted his chair away from the table.
Well then, you need not worry about any other applicants. There's not anyone around that's better than me in a one-on-one shootout. I could even handle 2-1 if necessary. If you gentlemen are satisfied, you've got yourself all the gun hand you'll need. By the way, who is this gunfighter?
Smoke Jensen.
Jaeger's chair legs dropped back onto the floor and his jaw sagged. Belatedly, he closed his mouth and swallowed hard.
If I weren't so hard up for work, I'd tell you just how crazy you are and hightail it out of here.
You've heard of him, I gather.
Heard of him? I grew up reading penny dreadfuls about Smoke Jensen. If only a quarter of it was true, he's pure hell on wheels. Not anyone I'd want to go up against alone. Hell, I'd be afraid to even try to backshoot him.
It is wise to have a healthy respect for an adversary, though hardly good to fear someone you are engaged to dispose of. Are you sure you can conquer your awe of Jensen long enough to make an end of him?
Of course I can. Long as I got me 3 or 4 good boys to back me up.
We were thinking of more like 20. Very well, Mr. Jaeger, consider yourself hired. We will, naturally, pay for your hotel accommodations and meals with a $2 a day stipend until we are ready to move on.
Is Smoke Jensen here? In Arizona?
Not that we know of. We assume we will need to do something to flush him out of his High Valley Ranch in the Colorado Rockies. Until we are in a position to do that, we must build up a sizable gang to make things happen as we want them to. Now, you can do us a first service. Spread the word to those of like inclination. Tell them we are prepared to be most generous.
Spectre paused a moment and pinned Jaeger with his cold eyes.
But don't tell them who they'll be facing.
After Gus Jaeger departed, Olin Buckner said out loud what was on all their minds.
Good thing that old Dockman was a miser, or we'd not be able to be so generous.
Yes, we'll have to act quickly to replenish our purse after our recruiting is ended here.
And what did you have in mind, Victor?
We've engaged the services of an expert highwayman, Ralph. I think we should find out all we can about the stage lines coming into here and what they carry.
Yes, and I'm sure there'll be banks along the way. By the way, where are we going?
North, perhaps as far as Wyoming. There's a place there guaranteed to make Smoke Jensen come to us.
Where's that?
You will all know when the time is right.
Over the next 3 days, they learned all that could be expected about the stage lines. Spectre and his partners also interviewed close to 25 men, among them certified hard cases, murderers, and a number of outlaw wannabes. They rejected all but two of the latter, and one of the killers, who had an odd cast in his eye that made him appear to be studying them for the best method of making their deaths long and excruciating. That left a trio of vengeance-hungry felons a total of 17 gun hands.
We'll get more along the way.
Why do we need more?
Simple, Olin. We have to have a veritable army to take over an entire town.
What town?
In due time, Olin. At the right moment, everyone will know. Now, please, do not bring up the subject again. Mr. Jaeger, notify the others that we will be leaving early tomorrow morning.
Right away, boss. And, call me Gus. Everyone does. And what should I call you?
Mr. Spectre.
An hour after first light, the 18 hard cases rode out of Grand Canyon with the partners. They left by twos and threes in order not to attract unwanted attention. Now, 20 miles out of town at a prearranged spot where the trail disappeared around the curved base of a large hill, they met.
Men! Gus here has considerable experience at holding up stagecoaches. Miller and Brock, as I understand, have some acquaintance with the technique as well. In a short while, a stage, heavily laden with the payroll for the Via de Cobre mine, will be coming around that curve. We are going to rob it. In order to do this, you will follow the orders of Mr. Jaeger. Mrs. Miller and Brock will direct the two phases of the operation. Obey them as you would myself, and we shall all enjoy the spoils.
We gonna split it up share for share?
No, Mr. Huntoon. My partners and I shall use the proceeds to pay you your new wage of $10 a day.
Now that's mighty generous, Mr. Spectre, but maybe we'd like equal shares.
I see. And would you also like to be left stone dead beside the trail?
No, sir. Not at all. No, sir.
Then leave the financial affairs of this jolly band to your betters, Mr. Huntoon.
What do you mean, my betters? You may talk like a dandy, but you probably ain't nothing more than another jailbird on the run. I saw your picture on a damn flyer in the post office.
We are your betters, you hillbilly trash. For the simple reason that we can read and write, and we do not dally with our cousins and sisters.
Oh, well, all right, boss.
Very well. Gus, divide the men according to your needs and get them in position. We haven't much time.
20 minutes later, the keener ears among the gang picked up the sound they were waiting for. It surprised Victor to see the nervousness amongst so many of his band of desperados. He trusted that they would perform better than it looked like they could. Then the flying manes and outstretched necks of the coach horses came into view around the corner. At once, men rode out of the brush and trees to either side of the trail and fired at the men on the driver's bench. Others blocked the roadway, and two of them reached for the lead horses. The guard's shotgun took out one of the outlaws. The return fire quickly ended the guard's life. A moment later, the driver dropped the reins and threw up his hands. He pitched forward over the dashboard and fell to the tongue. The horses came to a calamitous halt, the hind four ramming forward into the rumps of those ahead. Swaying wildly, the coach shuddered to a halt. From inside, a lone passenger fired a futile, unwise shot. Three rounds answered him. Silence followed. The masked men walked their mounts to the coach. Ben Brock dismounted and opened the door. The wounded passenger leaned outward, and two highwaymen helped him from the stage. They sat him against a boulder and ignored him thereafter. It took little time to discover the three large strong boxes filled with gold and silver coin. At the direction of Gus Jaeger, the stage horses were unhitched and their harness altered to serve as a pack bear tack. One iron-banded crate went on each of three, along with some of the load from the gang's pack animals. With the loads lightened, the hard-faced men removed their bandana masks and rode off without a thought for the wounded passenger. Spectre, Tinsdale, and Buckner remained very much on the mind of Smoke Jensen as he entered the low stone building next to the town hall. Monte Carson sat at his desk, a report form from the night man in one hand, a steaming cup of coffee in the other. He glanced up as Smoke entered.
I hear you were over to the telegraph office earlier. Didn't take you long to decide to look into the matter a little more, did it?
No, Monty. It just sat in my head and nod until I had to find out all I could. I telegraphed Yuma Prison for information. I'm waiting in town to see if I get an answer back soon.
Well, pour yourself a cup of mud and have a seat.
Monty Carson and Smoke drank coffee and talked about the latest goings-on in Big Rock for a quarter hour. Monty was telling Smoke about how Blue Nose Bertha, one of the bar girls at the Folly Saloon, had gotten her finger caught in a mouse trap when the door swung open. There stood a boy of about 11 or 12. Barefoot, he had a thick thatch of carroty hair above a balloon face of rusty orange freckles. His unfastened trouser legs ended at mid-calf, which gave him the look of an urchin.
Telegram for Mr. Jensen, Sheriff. We got an answer back from the folks out in Arizona Territory.
Smoke took the folded yellow form and handed the boy a dime.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Jensen.
Smoke opened the message and read from it. His eyebrows rose. He gestured toward Monty Carson with the sheet of paper.
Well, they've learned a bit more since that first telegram. The warden verified that they'd killed two guards and seriously injured another in their escape. The search has been fruitless in Mexico, but a dockman by the name of Hiram Wells, who lived upriver from the prison, was found murdered and his horse is missing. He also says a trustee told him the three of them had formed an alliance to get revenge on some unnamed man responsible for them all being in prison. A man who lives somewhere up in the mountain country.
Oh, hell.
Oh, yeah.
I think you and me, a couple of good deputies, ought to ride up to the Sugarloaf and ford up. That's what I think.
No offense, Monty, but I don't think that's such a good idea. No sense in bringing the fight home. In fact, the farther I can keep Spectre, Tinsdale, and Buckner from the Sugarloaf, the happier I'll be.
What do you have in mind?
Oh, I reckon to head into some friendly territory up in Wyoming way. Say, maybe Jackson's Hole. I can settle in, make my presence known, and let the word get out. Then, let them come.
Think they'll come alone?
No, Monty. They'll bring along help. Spectre used to run a large band of outlaws, numbered around 40. He's known along the Hoot Owl Trail. If he feels the need, he can get all the men he needs.
Why do you single him out as the leader of all this, Smoke?
Because I came close to blowing out his brains in the showdown we had. And I killed his only son. But look at it this way. When they come for me, and they will, I'll have these would-be avengers on ground I'm familiar with, and they know little about. That'll go a long way toward evening the odds.
Yeah? Well, I hope you're right, Smoke. I sure as hell do.
Victor Specter went to Hanksville, Utah to recruit more men. Hanksville hovered on the edge of Ute country. It had a white population of 57 and a scattering of Mexican and half-breed residents. It also served as a transient haven for men on the run. Specter signed on 11 more hard cases there. Men with shifty eyes and a day or more growth of beard, who found the pay acceptable and the promise of a bonus for killing a single man satisfying. Victor ordered a quick departure when he had all of the reinforcements he could expect to obtain. So far, their travels had paralleled the Colorado River, but here they would make a change. 5 miles outside of town to the east, Spectre halted the growing band and gathered them around.
We're heading north from here.
How far north?
Quite a ways.
I thought you said this fellow we're killing lives in Colorado.
He does, but we're not going there.
Upon hearing that, Finn Brock looked hard at Spectre, doubt clear in his narrow face.
Then how are we going to get him?
We make him come to us.
Farley Huntoon got in his nickel's worth.
Well, now that's just easier said than done, I reckon. Especially if he finds out how many of us there is. I mean, one man alone? He don't have to come up against us less than he chooses to.
There are ways, Mr. Huntoon, to make a man do anything you want him to. If you weren't such a dolt, you'd know that.
Say what? Are you trying to insult me, Mr. Specter?
No, Mr. Huntoon. I was praising the remarkable lack of genius engendered in the terminally inbred.
Oh. All right, then. I reckon that's no insult. Ain't often I get praised.
No, I expect not.
One of the new men, Judson Reese, better dressed than the average, touched his hat brim in a sort of salute.
Mr. Spectre, if we cannot have the exact location, can you at least give us a general idea of our destination?
I admire a well-spoken man. Yes, I'll answer that, since you put it so nicely. In the short term, I feel you men need some recreation. We shall pay a visit to the Utes. I hear there is a prosperous trading post not far north of here. Then we will be going on to Wyoming, perhaps even Montana. Rest assured, wherever we go, Smoke Jensen will come to us.
When Smoke explained over dinner what he had found out in Big Rock, Sally sat with her hands in her lap and stared at the checkered tablecloth for some time. At last, she raised her head.
What is it you're going to do?
I'm going to be gone for a while. It's me they want, not you, not the hands, not Bobby. Odds are they're unaware he exists. I'll put some distance between us and then let it be known where I am. The word will get to them. They'll come. And then I'll take care of them, the way I should have the first time around.
Well, I want to go with you, Smoke.
Bobby, that's out of the question. I have to do this alone and not endanger anyone else. Monty even offered me deputies of his own to help defend the Sugarloaf. I told him no.
I'm big enough. You've got to let me come. I can shoot, and I've been practicing with rifle and six-gun. Perla says I'm way above average shot, even from horseback. And you taught me how to live in the mountains.
Not another word, young man.
Bobby hung his head.
When?
I'll leave first thing tomorrow morning.
High up along the Colorado River, in the corner of Utah, the gang led by Victor Spector and his partners found the Ute Indians. From a distance, they eyed the low brush lodges of the Utes and the square outline of a trading post. The trader would be the engine agent.
I suggest that three or four of us ride down there first. We can size up the place and distract the agent. The rest of you be ready to come on full tilt when I give the signal.
Gus Yeager nodded.
Do you want me to come along?
Victor Spector cut his eyes to the lean outlaw.
No, Mr. Yeager. You stay here. Lead the men.
Good enough.
Spector picked Nate Miller and Judson Reese. Then he and Tinsdale and the two others rode off toward the distant building.